to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're a guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And later in the show, we're going to be talking about a new documentary regarding abortion rights, and we'll also be talking a little bit about, quote-unquote, democracy in America. But before we can move on, well, here we are, yet another twist and turn in the Trump-Russia saga, this time involving Donald Trump Jr. The reality is, and you really could never guess it from the headlines, we actually do not know if there was any real collusion between the Russians and Trump. This, however, is the first piece of information that has come out that at the very least seems to be within the ballpark of the collusion issue in any serious way. Nevertheless, the media in the U.S. has become totally breathless. The Washington Post noted with alarm today this was no longer just smoke, but fire. Ezra Klein intoned on Vox that, quote, no innocent explanations were any longer possible on this. The Post also ran an op-ed today saying the story shows explicit collusion between the two sides. Chris Hayes took to Twitter to mock critics of the Russiagate story, saying, quote, what else could you possibly need? So it's crucial here that we break down what is actually happening with this story to assess its actual significance. There are a few things that need to be separated out, though, before we get to Don Jr. Now, first and foremost, there are really separate allegations and stories merging into one another. First, did Russia actually hack LA election machines or election data in some way? Second, did Russia hack the servers of the DNC and John Podesta's emails, then give them to WikiLeaks, who then leaked them? And as a subsidiary question, did WikiLeaks know it was Russia? Related to this is whether or not Guccifer 2.0 and DC leaks, which also leaked info, were cutouts for Russian intelligence. Now, the second set of issues revolves around whether or not individuals in the Trump campaign actively colluded with Russia in any of what we just mentioned or in some other way. These charges center around a number of meetings had during the campaign and the transition between people associated with Trump and people, some of whom are Russian government officials, and now this lawyer and other Russians. You really have to look at these two claims individually, or look at all these claims individually, to get some sense of what we're really working with here evidence-wise, which then certainly will determine how one would react to this new news. So as far as the hacking of the elections itself, no one is even really making that claim, so we can just move on from that. Didn't really happen. While there are serious issues with voting machines, as we've detailed on this show, there's just no credible evidence of Russians hacking, quote-unquote, election machines. As for the election infrastructure writ large, while it doesn't appear that took place either, and no one is really alleging that it did, The Intercept, in their article detailing information allegedly from the NSA, allegedly given to them by Reality Lee Winner, suggest, without directly saying, that there was one county in North Carolina where Russians were able to hack the voter rolls and create long lines and confusion at the polls. Now, again, they just imply that without saying it because there's no real evidence, and local officials there vehemently deny it. So on this score, it seems more than fair to say there isn't really much there at all, and with about as much certainty as one can have in such matters, that Russia didn't, quote-unquote, hack the elections. Now, on to what certainly is more substantive and involved in this, and that is the issue of the leaks, the DNC emails, the Podesta emails, and the Clinton speeches. So in this one, we have no real idea what happened. WikiLeaks is saying nothing released by them was from the Russians. Guccifer 2.0 and DC leaks are widely believed to be Russian cutouts, but no one is saying for sure, which is a key factor when dealing with cybersecurity. This is truly a shadow world. In fact, skilled hackers routinely, as a matter of course, deploy all sorts of highly sophisticated technologies to cover their tracks. As many people will tell you, and as top cyber experts have related on this show, attribution is really not possible in these sophisticated hacks. Certainly educated guesses can be made, but the tech aspect of it just makes it too tricky, and in environments where multiple actors have motives, they more or less all can become equal suspects or something approaching equality. For instance, in the WikiLeaks release of CIA cyber weapons designed, they just showed how they designed a multi-layered tool that actually tries to make it appear that one actor tried to make it seem like someone else to further throw people off the scent. So, for example, it can make a hack look like China tried to make people think it was Russia, even though it was the U.S. all along. So you can see how this starts to get tricky. So if you want, you can work up a plausible narrative that Russia is behind all these leaks. But then you could also work up a plausible narrative about any number of other people being behind these leaks, or for that matter, multiple people being behind these leaks or whatever. So there is no evidence that quote-unquote Russia was behind these leaks. The mere fact that they technically could be and that there was motive behind it is certainly fair to raise and suggest as a theory, but it isn't fair to present it as gospel truth. I mean, quite frankly, given their resources, the Trump family could have just paid someone directly to hack these emails with great skill. Not that they did, but really it isn't as if the Clintons didn't have more than one set of people who did not like them, or that there aren't many people with resources who would have preferred a Republican president. So now, we come to the issue of all these various meetings. And this, of course, is the hardest to disentangle because we really know next to nothing about what was truly discussed, but there are a few things to remember here. First and foremost, outside of Don Jr., no one has actually alleged so far that any of these meetings amounted to collusion. And as all the quote-unquote the Russiagate supporters seem to be totally forgetting, their hero, James Comey, actually said in a congressional hearing that not only did he not see evidence of collusion, or at least he wouldn't talk about it, but that the FBI's assessment of what the goal was that Russia was just generally meddling to create chaos in the elections, and that their original goal, which was to help Trump, this is what Comey's saying, went into just creating general chaos. So they moved on from that. Now, of course, I've been critical of Comey too, but it's very relevant in how we view these various meetings. I don't really want to parse each one here because, one, we don't have all day, but we've discussed them all before on this show. But basically, it seems like the Trump team had various contacts with various Russians. But some context here is necessary. Basically, the entire campaign, Trump was talking about wanting better relations with Russia and at least implying that he would be open to lifting sanctions. So not that unsurprisingly, he attracted to his campaign people who felt the same way. So, of course, there is now a web of connections and meetings and the like which show connections between any campaign that would happen between any campaign and stated interests of said campaign. The meetings in and of themselves aren't really nefarious when the people doing them are openly talking about doing deals of various types with Russia. But we will come back to that. First, let's get to Don Jr. The basic story is probably known to many of you. Don Jr. took a meeting with a Russian lawyer under the belief that this lawyer had information damaging to Hillary Clinton that was provided by the Russian government, according to his contact. So, to figure out whether this is actually collusion, and we should say the Russians are at least saying that they had nothing to do with this, but anyway, moving on to say whether this is actually collusion, there are two things that need to be established. What was discussed and what was done based on that. According to Don Jr., no info on Clinton was actually provided. The lawyer says the same. She won't say what she says, but Don Jr. says it was about lifting sanctions on Russia, which makes sense because that's the issue that this lawyer, Natalia Veselnitskaya, that's a tough one, is most identified with. Further, it also makes sense because, I mean, what damaging information appears to have been released based on this meeting? Really doesn't seem to be anything. I guess if you wanted to stretch, you could argue maybe she told him about something being leaked by a third source to WikiLeaks or whoever, but ultimately, anything based on that is, at this point, total speculation. So we don't have any evidence of anything other than Donald Jr. being willing to use whatever information he could find, regardless of where it came from, against Hillary Clinton. In other words, he was willing to do basically anything to win. So, okay, fine. No one has to like that. People can call it whatever they want. But it isn't really evidence of collusion. And furthermore, Democrats should be a little careful what they wish for here, since we know a Clinton campaign operative paid Fusion GPS to hire Chris Steele, who then paid Russian government figures far more central to the Kremlin than this lawyer for information on Donald Trump, which reinforces another point we've been making on this show. The process of government is shady, and all sides are regularly involved in gray areas involving influence from foreign governments and big corporations. This is well known. In addition, let's not forget the New York Times thought Clinton had worrisome enough ties with a Russian uranium magnate and thought that this pointed to how the Clinton Foundation could be problematic in terms of foreign influence. They thought this was so important, they ran a major front page story on the issue, which brings us to our summation of this newest revelation. It's clear that people associated with Trump and people somehow associated with Russia met various times, and that some of his advisors are people who think the U.S. should work closely with Russia. It also seems fairly clear that some of these meetings involve the issue of sanctions. In fact, that aspect of the Donald Jr. story is in some ways one of the most relevant to this whole thing. Honestly, the picture being painted with the information we have so far isn't really all that nefarious. It seems clear that Trump was saying he wanted better relations with Russia and was getting people around him who agree. It then seems that some Russians, including some diplomatic and financial officials, sought to meet with the Trump camp at different times to discuss these issues. Undoubtedly, they were either talking about the challenges of doing many of these things Trump openly said he wanted to do or arguing for other things he should do. So Russia wanted to end sanctions. So did Trump. Some Trump people really want to win, and they were willing to take info from the Russians or anyone else. Was there a quid pro quo between these two things? Who knows? We actually do not know. But the fact that a non-nefarious narrative, easily crafted against the mainstream media narrative, reflects why the information in these various stories should be treated much more carefully, and that the media is doing us a disservice by allowing themselves to be the launderers of anonymous quotes, many of which are clearly politically motivated. So again, as we've stated, the media needs to reveal more of what they know, and the government should declassify more information so that the average citizen can have at least some ability to evaluate these claims more independently and more carefully. There are multiple investigations going on. Something more definitive will come out, and the constant Russiagate hyping of each story as if it's the story of the century certainly is helping Democrats hide from their election failures, but it's driving a dangerous neocon international agenda, making it more and more difficult for the two most powerful countries on earth to cooperate on anything of importance, which is absolutely not good for the world more broadly. And one final note here. Liberals are so massively up in arms about American democracy being under attack. Now, aside from the fact that the U.S. meddles in more elections than just about anyone else and has presided over clearly fraudulent elections like, say, Afghanistan twice, clearly this is a slippery slope. I mean, the same democracy that purged millions of people from the voter rolls, strange democracy to be celebrating. Where black people can be shot down on the street with impunity, strange democracy to be celebrating. All this hand-wringing over the U.S. elections potentially being meddled in is intensely myopic and totally ignores the serious democratic deficits in this country that cause almost 90 million people not to vote. The biggest problem facing America just isn't Russian election hacking. I'm sorry. And the intense hype around this entire story is totally undeserved. The U.S. political process is perverted, disrupted, and corrupted every day by many people who are not Russia or the Russian government. If you think Russia's so-called meddling is some unique outrage, wake up. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined as we continue our conversation here, switching gears just a touch, with Ben Mansky, who's an advocate, scholar, lawyer, and public speaker. Ben, thank you so much for joining us.
Eugene, happy to be here with you.
So I wanted to get your thoughts here to start on something that I think is quite interesting. Thursday, tomorrow, is going to be Barack Obama's first official political move post-presidency. He's holding a big fundraiser. It's for the National Democratic Redistricting Committee. For our listeners, that's the committee that Eric Holder is heading up on redistricting. And I don't know. I just don't really know what to think about this. I mean, it just seems like of all the things for him to kind of come back on a fundraiser says a lot. But then again, gerrymandered districts is a problem. So I don't know. I mean, there's a part of me that wanted to just kind of rip into him. There's a part of me that kind of said, well, I mean, I don't know. Maybe of all the things he could be raising money for, this is perhaps the least worst. Your thoughts?
I have the same reaction, honestly. You know, and obviously this is a little bit too little and too late in terms of the Democratic Party taking on the problem of partisan gerrymandering. We'll have to see how seriously they take it, because, of course, both of the major parties engage in partisan gerrymandering. And you know, you see it also particularly with specific redistricting fights. You know, as somebody who comes out of the Green movement and the Green Party in the United States, I've seen a number of cases in which Greens have been redistricted into the districts of other progressives or radicals who happen to be Democrats, pitting people on the left against each other. So this is a systemic problem. It's not simply a partisan problem. But on the other hand, certainly over the last 7 years, the Republicans have been much more aggressive and certainly a heck of a lot more successful in writing the district boundaries in order to advantage themselves. And my home state of Wisconsin is probably the textbook case of that. It's no longer Eldridge Gerry or Gerry. His name was originally a congressman from Massachusetts, but it's Wisconsin, where you have a state legislature that has been legislating in Wisconsin as if they had some kind of mandate to govern, and just, you know, punching holes in the university system and public education, parks, and so on. And never mind, you know, food stamps and health care for the poor and the elderly and children. But the reality is that when they were first got their majority in the state legislature, they didn't, you know, post gerrymandering, they had actually lost the popular vote in a pretty significant way. So obviously this has to be dealt with. How much credibility the Democratic Party as an institution has to deal with it is another question, but we can't leave it up to the Democrats and Republicans. This is a key fight for the democracy movement.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great point, and I think it sort of points to why I think this sort of fundraiser question is interesting to me, because to some degree it sort of speaks to this issue that I think progressives in this country are, well, I don't know, some are perhaps still grappling with, I think many haven't really confronted, which is sort of what went on in the Obama presidency and the fact that a lot of progressive causes were essentially subsumed or sidelined, I should say, under the need for quote-unquote party unity, protecting Obama from the Republicans and so on and so forth. And now here we are with President Donald Trump. And I think there's an undercurrent of, well, maybe we shouldn't have been so, I would say, soft in some ways on his administration. And it almost seems like the sort of hue and cry and the vexed reactions to this fundraiser are really kind of a continuation of that fallout or lack of reckoning so far. But I'm curious what you think about that.
No, I think you're right on. And I wouldn't just say to something, I'd say one of the central things that all of us need to be paying attention to, which is that reliance on the Democratic Party, whether they're in power or out, is never a safe strategy. You know, when the Democratic Party is out of power, eventually they figure out, it normally takes them 3 or 4 years, that they need to act like an opposition in order to gain support. So that, you know, after 3 or 4 years of the United States escalating its invasions and occupations in Central and West Asia, Afghanistan, Iraq, and other countries, the Democratic Party decides that they're a party of peace and they're an anti-war party for a series of wars that they themselves had advocated and pushed for when they were in power and when Bush first took office. So it took them a while, but then they become the party of resistance. And they come into power in part on a wave of anti-war sentiment. And then Barack Obama ends up escalating the very, you know, militarism that he had been a critic of. So we see the same cycle returning here. You know, the Democratic Party, you know, is now as a series of operations that have been derisively called resistance TM, like a trademark resistance that they have been building up. And now that they are in opposition, you see them turn to, you know, the democracy fight and say, you know, we got to do something about gerrymandering. We got to do something about voter suppression. We got to do something about voting rights. We got to do something about money in politics. But when they were in power, when Obama had that 2-year period in which he not only had the presidency and a huge mandate, but also control of Congress, they did nothing on those fronts. There were a few areas where there was some progress, you know, student loan reform and so on, but that's about it. Otherwise, it was business as usual. And so what does that mean for the rest of us? Well, it means that we have to build independent power. We can't be relying on those whose careers are built around their connection to established power to save us, because they won't. That's not the logic of their position. It's not that they're necessarily less ethical or moral people. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. You know, that's a conversation for another time. But it's that, you know, their incentives, their interests are not our interests. We have to build our own political parties, our own social movement organizations, and we have to move the Democrats. We have to move the Republicans. We have to move the entire system from below.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a good point. And I think it's one of those points that historically often gets lost. I mean, it's sort of, you know, big political shifts and realignments never really seem to happen or take place because someone at the top of something is doing something. You know what I mean? It's usually that kind of subterranean fire, as I think some people would say, who, I mean, from the abolitionist movement to the civil rights. I mean, it's just, I was reflecting on this with someone the other day about the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and how they rejected the compromise at the Atlantic City Convention. And I said, you know, most of the people a lot of them who are Democrats who would probably praise these people in retrospect would have denounced them viciously at the time because they were being seen as undermining Johnson's chances to win the election. A number of other civil rights people tried to stop them from having any civil rights demonstrations during the election period to do this, to help Johnson against Goldwater. And SNCC and Dr. King sort of broke with that, went ahead and did their thing, widely seen as, you know, courageous moments that helped reinforce this shift towards civil rights and certainly towards desegregating the Democratic Convention. But, you know, somehow we've lost that whole history, you know, and it's like everything has to be, oh, well, if, you know, Chuck Schumer or whatever doesn't say this is the direction, or if, you know, whoever it is, then we're never going to get there.
Yeah. And this is, you know, this is why movement culture, social movement culture is so important, so that we are constantly reminded ourselves, and we're reminding and teaching people who are coming into social movements, people who are deciding to become engaged into active makers of the, of their own history, that this has always been true. This is almost like a law of social change, that it is always the case that those who accomplish the things that are later honored in history were at the time in which they were engaged in struggle being treated as a threat. And pretty much everything that is great about our society, everything that has made America great, came about through struggle from below against what the established notion of what America was at the time.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Well, on that note, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back here with more with Ben Mansko, By Any Means Necessary, on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing our conversation here with Ben Mansky, advocate, scholar, lawyer, and public speaker. We left off talking a little bit about Obama's fundraisers and some of the challenges for progressive people moving forward and having our own issues and independence. And Ben, I wanted to keep this thing going because a phrase you used twice in the first segment that I thought was interesting was democracy movement. And I know certainly what you mean by that, but I think it's an interesting point in our current context because there's so much conversation, I think, around sort of the Russia thing and around many other things around, you know, American democracy being quote unquote under attack. And I thought about it when I woke up this morning and I said, well, man, like to some degree, what democracy? I mean, we've talked so much about police brutality and people not getting charged. And I mean, all these different things that go on, that there really is a democratic deficit in this country. And I think to some degree, in kind of this whole controversy over what happened in the election, we've sort of lost that. And this kind of mythical image of the U.S. as this perfect great democracy has sort of retaken hold when there's still so many battles being fought right now by people every day around sort of quote unquote core democratic issues. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that framing because I think it's important.
I think you're absolutely right that there has been a restoration of that image of a previously functioning democracy that supposedly existed 5 years, 10 years, 20 years ago in the United States, and that is then being counterposed against the Trump administration, which is clearly as anti-democratic as they come. But, you know, I also am not all that pessimistic that the sort of restoration of the image of some kind of mythical democracy is going to take hold society more broadly, because as you pointed out, there have been so many struggles in recent years across the United States and pretty much every corner of this country and certainly around the world around the question of who gets to decide, who makes the decisions, who rules, who is ruled. You know, whether you're talking about, who do the police serve? What is their function? Whether you're talking about what do universities serve? What do our schools serve and who's in charge? There have been all kinds of struggles that have involved tens of millions of people in this country in a daily way. So I think that because there has been so much mobilization and there's been so much engagement and frankly, so much learning through that process, that there is an awareness among a pretty significant part of our society that the United States certainly is not now, nor has it ever been, a genuine democracy, that for most people in this society, you know, we have not had a genuine say in how we live our lives or how our society is governed. And when I'm referencing the democracy movement, what I'm talking about, just to be very clear, is an emerging set of campaigns and sort of broader movements in society that focus on demands for a democratization of power. In other words, a shift to not only demand justice, but also to demand democracy. And you can see that in pretty much any sector of life, whether it's the response of the movement for Black Lives and Black Lives Matter more broadly in working for either, you know, abolition of the police or community control over policing and security and community safety, the local level across the country, whether it's in this continuing expansion of economic democracy through the growth of cooperatives and community-owned institutions in places that are increasingly well-known, like Jackson, Mississippi, with Cooperation Jackson, to you know, very small communities all across the country that in which people are building their own institutions that are democratically run and owned by the people in the community and the people who work there, whether it's sort of the shift in the student movement in the United States, where you've seen students demanding the abolition of tuition, which is basically an economic and racial bar on access to education, tuition is, and the creation of guarantees for full funding of quality public education for all in this country. That's a democracy demand. And those types of campaigns represent sort of a growing consciousness and a seriousness on the part of millions of people about the need to transform our society in a radical way, to move away from the sort of capitalist oligarchy that we are, which we have elected millionaires and billionaires who make the decisions, and they themselves are accountable to other millionaires and billionaires, and in which the basic institutions in which we live, in which we work, in which we study, in which we pray, in which we play, those are all governed by us directly.
Yeah, no, I think those points are all very well taken, and I'm glad you also raised the issue of economic democracy and some other related issues, because, you know, it brings to mind something else I've been thinking about a lot recently. I've been reading Ray Ginger's Eugene Debs biography, which anyone who's listening to this, I can highly recommend that book. Great book. And, you know, it's just interesting to see so much in the early sort of stages there as Debs is a socialist, just the conversation in the country around antitrust issues and the concentration of wealth. And I saw this tweet the other day. Someone asked Cory Booker what he thought about the Amazon Whole Foods thing. And he said, "I have concerns about the concentration of wealth in general, but I love my local Whole Foods and I think this is going to be great." And beyond that, which I thought was just like classic Cory Booker, I felt like it is interesting to me how we are actually looking at one of the most intense over the past 10 or so years moves towards deep concentration of wealth since that time, since around the turn of the century, early 1900s. But there really is no discussion in American politics about breaking up monopolies writ large. And I mean, I wonder how important you think that is to really raise that issue of monopoly power in a big way vis-a-vis what most people think, like that we live in a free market.
Yeah, I think that that is critical. I mean, in some ways, it's not just monopoly power, it's corporate power. You know, what we saw coming out of, to reference another period, what we saw coming out of the 1960s and the 1970s was a growing awareness on many people's part that corporations were consolidating, that they were buying each other out, that you had the increase in interlocking boards of directors, and then, you know, the use of subsidiary companies to sort of disguise what major corporations were doing. So if in the late 19th century it was break up the monopolies, and in the 20th century, in 21st century, the question really is, what do we do about corporations? And what do we do specifically about corporate personhood, the way in which corporations have been able to create a legal doctrine in which they use the Constitution and the Bill of Rights against we the people in order to prevent us from making even sort of limited gains around protecting our elections, protecting culture, protecting our certain sectors of our economy from domination by major corporations. So I think actually the struggle is going on. It has been going on, especially since the 1990s. And the form of the new 21st century form of what had been in the 19th century, the anti-monopoly populism, is this anti-corporate populism. And I think that is very widespread. And it's the reason why the majority of the people in the United States live in jurisdictions now in which either they or their elected representatives have voted for an amendment to the Constitution, making clear that corporations do not have the rights of natural persons and that money is not speech, that just because you have more money doesn't mean that you have protected rights to spend that money to buy politicians or to buy commercial advertising without regulation, et cetera. So that's what that's an outgrowth of. Now, it needs to go a lot further than that. And I think there have been a number of moments in the last 25 years in which the focus on the corporation as this institution of contemporary capitalism that is the way in which most of us are dominated much of the time, right? Probably nearly all of us. That focus on the corporation has been derailed. People have sort of lost sight of the ball because of sort of particular crises that were imposed on us, whether it was, the 9/11 and then the ensuing invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq and the expansion of the war on terror or any number of other examples. So I think part of the challenge for people's movements is to make sure that we keep our eye on sort of the larger period of struggle in which we live. And a larger period in which we live, I think for me, and I think for many of us, is defined by global corporations. They're not national. They don't have any attachment to you or me or to the land of the United States. But global corporations that dominate our economy, our culture, and our politics, and are, frankly, destroying our planet. We have to take them on. We have to break them up. We have to replace them with new economic institutions, cooperatives, community and publicly owned entities that are essentially like utilities. But we have all the alternatives. We have a lot of practice with those alternatives, with co-ops, with utilities, with public ownership. We know what works, what doesn't work. We have the alternative. The only question is, can we build the type of movement to take on global corporate capital and replace it with something genuinely democratic and just?
Yeah, well, I think that's a good point to segue to as well into something that you mentioned earlier, but I think is relevant to this at all. I mean, how are you evaluating the victory of Choka Antar Lumumba in Jackson? I mean, it's an interesting situation. A pretty radical social movement puts a guy into a Democratic primary. They win, become the mayor of a city, and then start producing these progressive issues. So it's an interesting overlay and cross-cutting around a lot of debates on the so-called quote-unquote left, although I don't really love that term. And I'm sort of curious what you think about sort of what in Jackson perhaps can be sort of scaled up and replicated. I'll just let you start there.
Yeah, I think that everybody should be paying attention to Jackson and frankly to a few other locations in which maybe there's been a little bit less deliberate sort of framing around this sort of strategy around political and economic democracy, but in which, organically you have the same kind of nexus between political movement and an economic movement. So my hometown of Madison, Wisconsin is another city in which you have this incredible sort of construction of a economic democracy in which tens of thousands of people live and work, and in which there are political parties of the left, to use that term that neither of us sort of prefer, I got to come up with a better one, that socialist and green and progressive parties that have people in elected office who work with those who are working in the community to build democracy from below. And there are other communities like that. I think that that's actually one of the most important things that all of us can be doing everywhere, is building up cooperation DCs and cooperation Bostons and cooperation Pittsburghs and cooperation LAs and so on. And to look at that model, to do it in a way that's appropriate to our community, and then to federate those efforts to bring all these sort of very well-grounded sort of projects at the local level together into national and international campaigns. The challenge the dysfunctional government in Washington, D.C., to challenge global capital and to show, the vast majority of people in this country that they really have a great working alternative to this dysfunctional economic and political system. So I think that what's happened in Jackson, Mississippi is very promising.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does seem that the local level is becoming a little bit of a laboratory here, Jackson, Mississippi. I think, you could probably also throw into that Seattle if you want. I mean, the one city with the socialist council member and then a sort of what seems to be sort of a powerful quote unquote third party movement. I believe they're calling it the Seattle New Left in the media out there rising. But, maybe a sort of switch. They always say that the lower levels, the Republicans, that those are the laboratories of democracy, right? But it seems like that's something that more progressive leaning people are taking advantage of now, too, the sort of relative autonomy that can come in some of these places. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that we are seeing the results of decades of work in places like Seattle and Madison, and frankly, Minneapolis and Cleveland, which both have green elected officials on the city councils and who are definitely on the left, and Boston and other places like that. So this has been a long time coming. We're starting to see it come into fruition and get broader attention. People are saying, oh, there is an alternative here. The other thing that we should pay attention to, though, is that corporate capital, major corporations and their lobbies are very aware that the base of power for working and poor people is in our communities. And so they have been working to take away, the authority of local governments. And so we have had these struggles all across the country, most infamously in Michigan, with the imposition of so-called emergency managers, where they essentially appoint dictators to run majority-minority, usually majority African-American cities in Michigan, and take away the elected mayors, elected city councils, just basically make them irrelevant. School boards, we've had struggles like that in my home state of Wisconsin with, frankly, the Democrats aligning with the Republicans in some cases to try to get rid of the elected school board in Milwaukee. But people fighting back to prevent that from happening, both progressive Democrats and Greens and others. And so this is a site of struggle, is I guess what I'm trying to say, is that it's not simply a question of building the alternative level, but it's of recognizing that our communities are under assault from above, that the attack on home rule through this doctrine of preemption is under full force right now. And basically, anybody who's listening who doesn't know what preemption is and doesn't know the history of home rule, this is a little self-education. Go out there, look up home rule and preemption. There are some good resources. One great set of resources is from the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. They have a really good history of the struggle for home rule, why people, at the end of the 19th century were fighting for home rule, the progressives, the populists, the socialists are at the front of that. And it's many of the same reasons why people are building up community power today to take on corrupt state level and national administrations, to provide an alternative, to provide services like at that time, sewage, transportation, education, other services that were entirely private and were at the mercy of predatory capitalists. And people said, we need to provide these for ourselves. And so they developed that model. And it was a struggle then. It's a struggle that progressives have largely abandoned over the last 100 years, but now are being forced to engage in again and to relearn the history. So that's a way forward. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that in a couple of weeks, hundreds of people from around the United States are gathering in Minneapolis for the third Democracy Convention. And all the things that we've been talking about are going to be front and center and a subject for people talking about. So what's the latest? What do we need to do next in terms of building a democracy movement in the United States? So you can find out about that at democracyconvention.org.
Well, we've got a couple minutes left. I mean, say a little bit more about that. Who are some of the people you're expecting, and a little bit more about what people can expect if they're curious and coming out?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are actually over 150 presenters. So there'll be lots of workshops, and the people who are presenting these workshops, I mean, they're intellectuals, they're thoughtful, but they're also people who are doers, right? They're people who are doing the organizing work in the area in which they're about the subjects in which they're talking. We tend to have a very participatory style. So you show up to a workshop and you not only get to ask questions, but you get challenged to look for solutions, right? So this is not, your normal sort of the politician shows up, gives a speech, everybody applauds and they go home. This is really about building networks, about sort of building the movement. The way in which the Democracy Convention is organized is also kind of different from the way anything else that I've been to is set up. It's 8 conferences that take place at the same time. And each of them deals with a different area of life in the United States, a different sector, like education or sort of war and peace or constitutional law or the economy. So for example, there's a Community and Economic Democracy Conference. There's a Education United for Democracy Conference. There's a Representative Democracy Conference. There's a Racial Justice for Democracy Conference. You can go to the website and see all of them. They all have their own agendas, their own plenaries, and then they're all working to sort of build synergies, to cross over between each of them, so that we can unite people who are working for democracy and education with those who are working for media democracy. and build, you know, a genuine, broad, but also deeply rooted democracy movement in this country. So this is a very deliberate strategy that we're all engaged in. People are coming from many different struggles, many different communities. We have some great keynote speakers as well. There'll be a plenary panel on Friday night, August 4th, on building an inclusive democracy movement to overcome oppression. So it's sort of the central question that we're taking up. You know, how do we really build a movement in which we're all in this together? We have each other's backs in a meaningful and conscious way. And then also on Sunday, we'll be doing for the first time a People's Movement Assembly, which will be a mass participatory process, a well-facilitated, you know, in which people will be coming together to develop strategy and common goals for 20 years.
Well, should be interesting for sure. A lot there at the Democracy Convention. Definitely check it out. And thank you, Ben Mansky, for joining us here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. We're going to take a break. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about a new documentary, Care in Chaos, which examines how police in two cities protect or fail to facilitate appropriately patient access to abortion care in the face of intimidation by anti-choice protesters. And very apropos to our topic, we are very happy to be joined here by Lindsay Beierstein, who's the director of Care in Chaos, and Calla Hales, who's a clinic administrator and a subject of the documentary. And I want to thank you both so much for joining us here today.
Yeah, thank you.
No, of course. The pleasure is all mine. I wanted to start here by setting the stage just a touch, maybe sort of historically and contemporaneously, for some of the issues that the movie or that the documentary, I should say, really touches on. So, Lindsay, I'll start with you here. But I think for our listeners who may or may not know, but I think there's a lot of people who do know. I mean, this is also the issue of sort of clinic protest, attacks, terrorism is not like a minor issue. I mean, it's inspired federal legislation, local legislation. If you could first just set the stage a little bit on the history of the importance of understanding this.
Sure. We're living in an era of increased pressure on abortion clinics nationwide. We have a very active anti-choice movement in this country, and it goes back decades to the 80s and 90s, which prompted federal legislation called the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, which is supposed to defend abortion clinics, and to some extent does, but it's not really very well enforced at the local level. I've talked to activists and lawyers who specialize in this kind of thing, and they say that the laws are on the books, but people are not being trained at the local level, and it all comes down to whether local police departments are with the program, whether they know the law, and whether they're willing to step up to enforce it to protect people's rights.
And, you know, Calla, I'm very curious here, as you work with, you're the head of a Preferred Women's Health Center, which is a group of independent clinics as well, so you have a lot of direct experience with this. I mean, what is the impact here? I mean, give us some sense of what it's like both for patients and for providers in situations where they're essentially forced to run a gauntlet to, you know, either gain care or do their job.
For patients in particular, it can be incredibly just intimidating and stressful and traumatic. They're there to receive health care legally, and particularly in Charlotte, no matter when you come, you're going to face somewhere between 30 and 100 protesters outside, depending on the day and the weather, which is outrageous. And it's unexpected because you turn a corner and then they're there. It's hard as a patient to really understand that and prepare yourself for it. It's hard. As a provider, gosh, it's really hard. There are days where you really question if you really want to continue living in this level of stress and just terror, really. And there are other days where you just kind of get numb to it and for survival instinct?
You know, it's a good question. I wanted to just sort of set the stage because I think this is a very interesting approach that the documentary takes to this issue, which is two different cities that you look at there. And, you know, both cities have totally different realities. And a lot of that is based on the way things are policed as much as the law in and of itself. So, Lindsay, let me start there. As the director, you know, what made you want to take this particular approach?
We felt that there hadn't really been enough done on the role of law enforcement. We wanted to do kind of a tale of two abortion clinics type story, you know, the best of times and the worst of times. And even in North Dakota, which is really the best of times, but it's like it doesn't exactly suck too hard because the police are out there actually doing their job. They have a wonderful downtown resource officer who is one of the characters in our documentary, and she's always available to the clinic. They have a great relationship. She makes her phone number available. So she can take texts anytime, and she'll come down, and she has a good relationship with the protesters, too, where everybody respects each other and feels like they can talk to her about stuff that comes up, and she's very concerned about people being able to express their First Amendment rights. But she also wants to make it clear that this is a place of business, this is in our community, and she protects it just as much as any other business in the downtown core on her beat.
I think it's interesting to see. I mean, I think if you were to say to have me sight unseen, Fargo, North Dakota, Charlotte, North Carolina, what place is going to do a better job of keeping protesters from harassing, abusing, potentially attacking people, places where abortions are provided? I would have guessed Charlotte, you know, 90% of the time. But, Calla, that is not the case. Charlotte, of all places, kind of the opposite of Fargo, North Dakota. You said you spoke a little bit about it in the last question I asked you, but talk about what the scene is like for you guys on a daily basis there at Preferred Women's Health Center.
So we get protesters every day. Obviously, slower weekdays like Wednesday get a little bit less, probably somewhere between 15 and 30. We typically have two crisis pregnancy center RVs that park in front of our office that try to flag in patients and convince them to not get a procedure completed. On Saturdays, it's kind of like walking into a war zone. And I wish I was exaggerating, but we're seeing now upwards between 100 to 300 protesters regularly on Saturdays, and special events. Earlier this year, we had a 1,000-man march on the clinic. Last December, we had a 5,000-person march on the clinic where streets were completely full. It's chaos. As you mentioned, you know, policing is incredibly different as well. Since that 5,000-person march in December, I can thankfully say we've at least started to have a working relationship with the police, but it's still very much in that beginning phases. There's not a lot of, I hate to say communication, but there's not a lot of clear, concise policing, and there's not a lot of clear understandings of what ordinances really mean.
And the clinic is under assault with sound. This is a big theme in our movie, too, which is they get an amplified sound permit, the protesters usually. They get about 80% of the clinic. The protesters get the permit about 80% of the time, and they get on the PA, and they just yell at the top of their lungs about how God hates you, God hates your descendants, maybe you should rethink having your rapist baby because, hey, turn that frown upside down. And you can hear it all the way. They've got layers and layers of concrete in the clinic. So people actually on the examining table can hear someone on the PA system yelling at the top of their lungs about how they're a sinner.
I wish that had gotten better, but it really hasn't. Sound is still a major problem. It's a major issue. We call the police multiple times a day on that, typically. Like Lindsay said, they are also very hostile and unfortunately graphic. And it's really a crappy place to be as both as a provider and as a patient and as someone who has to deal with this all the time. Like, it is mental trauma 24/7.
No, I mean, I certainly can see that for sure. And I mean, I'm just curious, Lindsay, because you were speaking earlier about the police chief in Fargo and how it's important for her to protect all the businesses, to have an even-handed thing for everyone who's operating any sort of legally licensed establishment. I mean, what are the police saying in Charlotte? I mean, what is their excuse? Is it just that they don't know what it is, or it's gray area, or I mean, what are they saying?
Well, the protesters are generally on public property, and they're saying, and they have something of a point here saying, well, you know, that they have a right, they have a point in the sense that, yes, the protesters have a right to be there, they have a right to express their First Amendment views, they're getting the sound permit, so they have the right to use the equipment. But on the other hand, the police are not doing anything to actually enforce the laws to keep the sound levels low. So even the city manager of Charlotte admits, well, it's just a cat and mouse game because terrain is such that the terrain is such that they can't get an unobserved reading on the sound, so the police can be seen pretty much if they're close enough to take a reading. And then, of course, the volume goes down, so it's just a cycle that repeats itself day after day, many times a day. And it's the same with traffic stuff. If the police officer doesn't see it, it doesn't happen. And they don't invest the resources. They don't care. They don't want to put an officer on the scene to stand there and watch what happens, because they don't see the times that the protesters get in front of people's cars, which is illegal. I thought it was ironic when we were filming, the police took the time to order us out of the street, but not the protesters.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting on so many different levels. And one thing that I am curious about, Calla, as well, which is just a, you know, I should have said this earlier, but an addendum to another question I have is, you know, being in North Carolina, I don't know, but I can certainly imagine that a lot of folks who must come to get services from you guys must be coming from, for lack of a better term, I hate to say it like this, middle of nowhere, rural areas, where I'm sure there's probably already a decent amount of stigma perhaps in the community around certain activities. I mean, is it almost like an extra impact in places like where you are in Charlotte, because there are so many people who desperately need these services but can get them in so few places and are being so heavily demonized when they seek care?
Absolutely. I know earlier last year there was a report coming out that said Charlotte had one of the worst economic mobilities in the United States. And it is so clear that there are so many people in need of abortion care for whatever reason it is. For some people, yes, it is for economic reasons. But the stigma throughout the South is just so heavy. And it's not necessarily in Charlotte itself, but it's people coming in from the outside cities and towns, busing in homeschool kids for field trips and having them stand outside the clinic. That's happened multiple times this summer, where you have 30, like 10 to 15-year-old kids standing outside yelling and screaming at patients saying, "You could be my mom."
That's I'm a little floored by that. It just shows how deep it goes on so many different levels, on so many different pieces. I mean, it is interesting sort of as well, Lindsay, maybe juxtaposition of the cities, because I've often said to people that I think that in the South and other places too, but certainly the South, that you're almost like a Jim Crow system for reproductive rights and the way it's playing out. I mean, do you see much of in the investigative work and research you've done a North-South divide on this, East-West, or, you know, urban-rural, or is it just kind of, it's very particular to the specific towns and cities?
I would say that in general, that large coastal cities, college towns, tend to have a more accepting and supportive environment around reproductive rights. But, you know, reproductive rights are under assault all over, and that, you know, even people that run clinics in really progressive areas have told me some really hair-raising stories about the protesters that they encounter and the abuse that they go through. So it's a problem all over.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Some friends of mine do a clinic defense every Saturday in New Haven, Connecticut. Certainly not a very not known for being a quote-unquote reactionary area, but the things that people say and do are just shocking to me every time I hear the stories. And I'm also curious too, Calla, what are you hearing from politicians? Because they're passing laws and putting things out there that, you know, could be protecting you guys way more if they were policed correctly. I mean, are you hearing from people in the political sphere who are upset, who are, you know, looking to hold hearings, hold people accountable? Where is that at?
This is a loaded question, sir. I'm hearing a whole lot of silence, to be fair. I've reached out a lot into city management, into city politicians, and even state politicians. I'm finally starting to get the beginnings of responses, and it has taken me going to national media to do it. I'm not sure how to take that, but I'm going to keep following it up until we get an answer. It's unfair for my staff. It's unfair for my patients. It's unfair for me.
Well, let me ask you this follow-up, too. I mean, how important was it then to do a documentary where you all can really just speak for yourselves, more or less, than have to have it mediated through any particular, you know, individual outlet or whatever, but really just get your story out?
For the provider angle of that, it was really important. It was not a decision I took lightly, and I know Lindsay knows that I struggled with this for a while, of do I really want to put myself in the media and put it in the spotlight and make myself a target? And I just did it twofold. The answer is, if I don't do it, it's not just me that suffers. It's my fellow providers in the same areas and all over the United States
that are still going to suffer if no one starts paying attention. It's the
she won't be able to receive care. And with so many attacks on reproductive rights as it is, that number is already dwindling. So it was really one of those moments where you had to put up or shut up. And Lindsay and everyone at Rewire really made sure that they got to the bottom of this matter, and it's been an amazing supportive process with them.
Yeah, well, and I think for people who are listening who don't know, very serious. Many providers have been assassinated by terrorists. Obviously, many people listening to this may remember George Tiller, who was killed in 2009, and previous to that had been shot before, had his clinic firebombed. So these aren't small stakes here. These are very serious stakes that are out there. And Lindsay, I'm curious from your point of view, the importance of this documentary, because I mean, this is an issue that, you know, I can remember sort of in more political formative years in the 90s when a lot of this was happening. It was like it was a huge, huge political issue nationally. It's not one that the CNNs and the MSNBCs rush to in the same way unless something really, really tragic happens. How important to doing this documentary was it for you?
That was very important. I feel like people don't understand the kind of low-level harassment, the kind of climate of contempt and siege that eventually leads to larger violence. These kinds of actions, like what Scott Rutter did to Dr. Tiller, didn't come out of nowhere. They come out of a climate of hate and lawlessness and impunity where people think that they can do whatever they want and they'll never come back on them. And if you go down to an abortion clinic like a Preferred Women's, like Callas, you'll see these people think they own the street, they own the airwaves, they own everything. And the police are not pushing back, the community's not pushing back. And my view as a journalist is that sunlight is always the best disinfectant. The people have to see the stuff. They have to see it represented. They have to feel what we felt just looking at this scene of chaos down at the clinic and understand that something has to be done. And I want that to be done in a way that respects everybody's rights to express themselves and to protest and do those things. But there are limits, and they do have to follow the laws that are on the books at the very least.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's I've been involved in many protests in my day, and even in many very, very spirited ones. It's hard to imagine a lot of folks acting the way that some of these people have acted. And, you know, one thing you mentioned earlier, Calla, that I'm just sort of curious about that is obviously relevant to this is you were saying that the crisis pregnancy centers have these RVs, which is – I don't even know what to say about that, that they're parking right in front. But I was hoping you could say a little bit of the impact these crisis pregnancy centers are having, because I honestly feel that it's heavily underplayed. I mean, here in Washington, D.C., which is a very liberal city, there are dozens of them, and they're advertised everywhere, and they're so easy to find. It's not as easy to find Planned Parenthood for obvious reasons, because they're so directly targeted on such a regular basis. But for a lot of people who are looking for help, you know, you go to what you see.
Absolutely. I've had more interactions with crisis pregnancy centers the past 2 years than I ever wanted to. In Charlotte, we have these two mobile RVs that park in front of the clinic. One in particular will wear purple scrubs, which look similarly like the Novant Healthcare scrubs, which are already around the city as the hospitals. They're all Novant systems. So they look like a very legitimate organization. And, you know, I've had patients tell me that they were told that they were miscarrying or that they were much further along once they'd gotten on this bus, which is horrifying to hear. I've also had a lot of interesting interactions with other CPCs in different cities. I have another clinic in Raleigh where the CPC was originally across the street and is now trying to move into the building next door to our facility, and compared it to putting a Burger King next to a McDonald's, because I don't know where that's the first thing I would think of to compare women's health care would be fast food, wouldn't you? It's that type of just underhanded mentality across the board that is just shocking and startling to me. In North Carolina specifically, our state budget just passed and CPCs across the state are getting $1 million of our state budget this year.
Wow, that says a lot. Well, I really appreciate you guys coming on. Great new documentary, Care in Chaos, put together by Rewire.News, which is a great overall site. So please, please, please check out the documentary. Follow Rewire.News. Thank you so much, Lindsay and Calla, for coming on and really, quite frankly, for doing this documentary, which is a very important thing to be discussing. That is going to do it here for our show today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
By any means necessary.